if somebody else can learn from me telling about how you handle loss, how you can handle the affairs you had in your marriage or whatever problems you can get into, you can say I use myself as an illustration of, you know, human life.
That was Lona Funk, and this is Nordic Portraits. Lona Funk is an award-winning author, scientist, and journalist, who over the past 30 years has established herself as one of the leading voices within the field of neurobiology, scientific technology, and ethics. Her very personal relationship to scientific research was laid bare in Pernille Rosa-Goncker's 2014 documentary, Genetic Me, and Lona continues to explore this rich subject matter through her regular appearances on television and radio programs, as well as her feature articles in Weekendavisen. Lona, welcome to Nordic Portraits.
Well, thank you very much.
Lona, I wondered if we could start by discussing your latest book, Største Alt.
Yeah.
The Greatest of All.
Yeah. I regret to say it's not out in English. I wish it were. But it's about love. What I would call it in English, I would call it love factually.
Right.
Because it's really about all the things that you usually don't write about or hear about when you do something about love. All the science that surrounds love, what we know about love and the brain, love and hormones, love and sociology, all this kind of stuff. And mixed in with that is my personal story.
And apropos your personal story, I'm curious what it was specifically that first led you to want to scientifically examine the notion of love.
Well, it was disaster, really. It was the loss of love. I was living with my boyfriend. We had been together for 13 years, and he got cancer. He died in just 6 months, went from, you know, apparently well to completely wasted away and died within 6 months. And I was sort of left there all alone because I have no children. I have no family, basically. My parents are dead. I have one brother who I haven't spoken to in years and years, and no other immediate family. My old friends didn't really show up. So I just lay there on my gray couch and felt sort of how big a negative space this loss of love left in my life. And I am the kind of person who has never really given much thought to love and its role. I mean, I have always been very interested in the world and, you know, I was all about my work, my job, what I wanted to do, the books I wanted to write, the podcasts I wanted to make, the films, whatever. And my personal relationship was always just something, oh, yeah, it's good. It works. It's, oh, he's a great guy. Yeah, yeah. We love each other, you know. But I didn't really think much about it. And then suddenly I could see that, whoa, this, you know, love relationship has really been a pillar in my life. I couldn't have done anything without that. And so I wanted to look into how do we develop our relationship with love, our way of thinking about love as, you know, individuals. And my way of going about things is always, if I'm interested in something that has to do with human nature, human feelings, human thoughts, whatever, I always go to science and look at, so what do we actually know? What do we know about this aspect from a species point of view, evolutionary angles, perspectives, and biochemical and sociological, all that kind of knowledge that's out there? And I thought, well, love is just the topic for this, because usually people will say, well, if you want to know about these big questions, these big perspectives in life, you have to go to poetry, philosophy, religion, perhaps, because you can't ask science. It doesn't know about these big questions. Of course it does. You always, if you want to know about people, always have to go to science. different kinds of science, different fields in science, but you have to look at humans always through the lens of science, because we're an animal.
Hmm. And what answers did science provide?
Well, lots of answers, or lots of perspectives. First of all, of course, you always have to go to evolution and ask the question, okay, if you have this phenomenon, this fascinating phenomenon of love, however you define it, where did that come from? Why do we have it? Why do we have this thing among people, something that binds together couples, binds together friends, binds together, of course, parents and offspring and all that stuff? And from that angle, it's not simple, in fact, because when you think about it, we are a mammal. Among mammals, only 3-5% of all the species out there have what you would call a pair bonding, like we do. 3-5%. And all our closest relatives, the big apes, they don't have it. So where did it come from in the human species? Where did love and pair bonding come from? So that's where it starts off. And then, you know, I go in to look at theories of how love evolved, probably out of our children having to be so immature when they're born. So probably 500,000 years ago, what happened was that the brain started really growing in our ancestors, and it became so big that children had to be born very prematurely. And so it was no longer possible to raise children, you know, by just having the woman, the mother, raise it. It was simply not possible. There would have to be someone to help take care of this offspring and to take care of the woman with the baby and so on. So probably that's when love and pair bonding evolved. And it took off from there.
Yeah.
Hmm? That's just one example of how science, you know, has something to say about things.
Hmm. I found it interesting as well, reading the book, that as you examine the scientific grounding of love, you also reflect a lot on your own story.
Yeah.
And at one point you reveal that in many ways you felt that loss had become your identity.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's really hard to explain how, you know, how devastated I felt at that point in my life. It's about 8 years ago now. But it was really sort of, it was a before and after. And I just sat there for a long time before being able to do anything again. And yeah, I came to think of myself as, you know, she who has lost everything in a way, which was also something that I knew from my childhood, because I lost my mother when I just turned 18. I was in high school and she died of cancer. And I remembered back that, yeah, that was the way you felt, wasn't it? I saw myself as the girl who lost her mother for so many years before getting out of that and really starting to look at myself in life in a different way and not thinking about myself as, oh, that girl who lost her mother.
But it feels like throughout the course of the book and the way it's constructed, obviously, is that you do not only come to terms with the fact that you need love in your life and that you took it for granted, but that you actually are willing to take a chance on it again.
Oh, yeah.
For someone who feels quite rationally wired, was that actually a byproduct of having undertaken this research project that helped you come to terms with that?
I think I have sort of gotten much more, this sounds horrible, but I have become much more in touch with my own emotions, as you would say. Or at least I give them more thought instead of just going ahead as I was before. I'm thinking much more these days about, okay, you have maybe, let's say, 20, 30 years left. How do you want to use those years? Is it really going to be all about what you can do and what you can produce? Or is it also going to be about emotional experiences, love, other kinds of feelings? So I think I would say I have kind of, I have changed because of that loss at that time in my life. Yeah.
If we reflect on your very early years, you were born and raised in Aarhus, up until the point in time where your parents moved you and your brother out to the countryside.
Oh, yeah. Way out to the countryside. So for the longest time, that stood in my mind as that's where calamity began, really. That's where my unhappy childhood began. Because when I look back on my early childhood, it was really good. I mean, I had a really close relationship with my father always. He very much raised me, in fact. Also with my mother, but certainly with my father. And I was raised in, you know, that nice suburb of Aarhus, and life was good. Playmates in the street, da-da-da-da. I went to school, everything was good. And then I think I was 9, my parents decided to up and leave and sort of go to this remote place in the country. And we lived in a farm there. They still worked in Aarhus, and I demanded to stay in my school. So I would ride with them in the car, 45 minutes there, 45 minutes back every day. And I hated being in the country. I mean, there was nothing there. No one to talk to, no one to play with, far away from everything. And my parents, it turned out, of course, made that move in order to save their marriage, do something, blah, blah. And that didn't work. So 3 years it was out there. Basically 3 years in hell, I would say. It was really bad. And it came to, you know, an eruption. They got divorced. It came out that my father was drinking and had basically ruined the family. And so I and my little brother, we went with my mother to live in another suburb of Aarhus, which I didn't particularly like. And my father stayed in that place in the country with a new wife. And it was just, I don't know. Yeah, I always had the picture of nice childhood, really good childhood up till the age of 9, and then crap. And yeah. And then, of course, my mother died.
Yeah. Which was this 3-year ordeal you had to walk through right in the middle of your teenage years.
Yeah, I mean, I had just started high school when she was diagnosed with cancer, and her mother had died of breast cancer as well. And yeah, she just got sicker and sicker over 3 years and died. And that was just, that was horrible. I mean, when I think of my teenage years, people always talk about being a teenager and all the things you get up to, and, you know, you start drinking, or maybe you try drugs, you do all this stuff, and you run around with boys or girls or whatever, you discover adult life. I just sat at home in my room in that suburb and read books and felt sorry for myself. I was a miserable existence, really. And I look back on it, I was like, at this distance, I mean, it's almost funny. But it wasn't, of course, at the time.
And not to draw false comparisons between the two, but you described how you felt after your boyfriend had tragically passed.
Yeah.
What did Lone Funk at 18 look like in terms of trying to reset, reestablish yourself, find out who you are as an adult, and navigate that shortly after your mother had passed?
Well, strange thing is really that what happened, you know, there was again that, of course, immediate devastation. But it was also at an age and a situation where, what could I do? I couldn't at that point just sit in a sofa for 6 months. There was nobody was really thinking anything else that, okay, yeah, she'll go back to school in a week, which I did. And, you know, we'll help her find another place to live because, yeah, my home was gone and I had to go live in a dorm and go back and forth on the train to high school for that last 6 or 7 months of the year. And so my life just drastically changed. Suddenly I was out living among other people my age or a little older. And there was no one around, no parent. My brother was gone. He was only, 7 or 8 or something, and living with my uncle. And so I basically just in a couple of weeks went from living with my very, very sick mother and my little brother to being on my own and having to, of course, deal with high school and finish and graduate and get good grades so I could get to university and all that stuff. So I would say, in a way, I must have sort of suppressed an awful lot of grief and an awful lot of emotion in order to simply get into that new life. And what happened was that in, I don't know how long it took, but it didn't take long to sort of change from being that sad, miserable existence to, in fact, engaging with life and trying to, you know, get out there. And I think, in a way, I must have even been almost relieved. I don't think I was conscious about it, but the relief of there's no more sickness, that burden is kind of gone. Now I just have to look ahead and do something and go out and meet people and go to university, experience the world.
And what role did science play at that stage of your life?
I won't say it at first played much of a role. I had a vague idea in high school that I would study biology because I had been really interested in, you know, I had a great course in biology in high school and we got onto brain science and that just felt like, whoa, that's maybe where I should go. Before that, I thought I'd be an architect or an archaeologist or, you know, all sorts of ideas. Anyway, I got to university after I had a gap year. I went to Israel, Middle East, toured around, worked on a kibbutz for a while, that kind of stuff. Met an awful lot of people. Really interesting. Really good for, you know, instead of just going from high school to university, I think that was one of the greatest things I've ever done, is just take that gap year, go away, meet people, see the world, do something, grow up. And I really grew up in that year. Anyway, then I went to university to study biology. And going to university felt like freedom. It was a great, great experience. So I acquired a taste for science and for what it means in a bigger perspective. I was never the sort of very nerdy, oh, I'm really, really interested in knowing how brain cells do this or do that, or really, really interested in birds or algae or whatever people are, you know, interested in. It was more of an overarching understanding that, wow, getting to the bottom of things in the natural world, that really means understanding the world. That means understanding ourselves. So in that way, I saw science as, wow, yeah, of course, a field that I wanted to explore.
And I think that's what I find really compelling about your craft is the ability to communicate these complex ideas, but in a way that always helps us come back to a better understanding of why we are the way we are.
Yeah.
And I think there's no better example of that than Genetic Me, the 2014 documentary.
Mm.
I'm interested in what led you to team up with director Pernille Rose-Goncker and what it was like for you to be both the subject of the film as well as the authoritative voice in that.
And also the writer of it.
Exactly.
Basically. Yeah. So it was very much a collaboration, which was, it was great. She is, I mean, I'm in awe of her in many ways. And we've done two films together, which has been really, really great. But anyway, why do a documentary on genetics and specifically your own genetics? Well, it came out of a book, My Beautiful Genome, which was a sort of exploration of, okay, when the consumer genetics age came about around, what, 2008, 2009, something like that, suddenly you, the consumer, could go out there and have your genome tested, know things about your own heritage. And that just sort of led me to want to explore, okay, what can we actually know? What can our genetics tell us about ourselves? Of course, you know, what people mostly talk about is what kind of diseases will you have? What risk of this or that? Didn't really interest me that much. But more, what can genetics tell us about why am I the way I am? I mean, how much of my personality is in there? How much of my psyche is due to something as weird as information curled up in every cell of mine? Mostly people will think about their personality, their love life, their feelings, their thoughts, as something that, of course, comes from the life they've lived, the environment, their upbringing, all that stuff. But it turns out, the more you look at it, the more you understand that the basis of all this is really, what did you get in that genetic lottery? I mean, so much of your personality is genetically determined. And so it was that whole area which Pernille and I, after the book came out, we said, well, why don't we make a film about that chapter in the book that has to do with personality, psychological makeup? Where does that come from? How genetic is it? What is genetic about it? And when you know that, what can you do?
And for you personally, that analysis brought about quite a tumultuous period for you to reconcile with.
Yeah, it was interesting because, I had a personality test. That's where we started. Okay, let's see what we're dealing with here. And I had never had a personality test before. You know, I haven't really sort of been very interested in my own psychology in that way. But it turned out that I still remember it's that five-factor model, NEOPIR test, that is sort of the gold standard scientifically of personality testing. And you answer these almost 300 questions related to how you react in life to different things, what you think about yourself, how you see yourself. And then it's analyzed. And I went to see the psychologist who analyzed it. And when I came into the room, he said, oh, you're Lona? Yeah, I am. Oh, well, I have to say, I wasn't looking forward to meeting you when I saw your test. Whoa, thank you very much. What it came down to was that you analyze a personality on five factors or five scales. Your openness to experience new things, your degree of extroversion and your degree of neuroticism and your conscientiousness and your agreeableness. And the way I scored on agreeableness was I scored rock bottom. It was like, as he told me, I have never, ever seen that in a woman. Never. I mean, it's like, whoa, okay. It was interesting. I score fairly high on neuroticism, which makes sense. I'm a person who, I worry about things and I see the negative aspects of everything before I see the positive, definitely. So with that personality, we went about looking for, okay, so how much of that is genetic? Can we say anything about it? What do we know? And we went into the genetics of personality. What it is that I go around visiting these scientists who are sort of leading in various fields, look into genetics, brain biology, so on and so forth. And it turned out that, and that was very interesting, I think, that when you look at genetics, we have known since the 70s, it has been tested over and over in twin studies and so on, that personality is basically 50% genetic. That means the variation in a population, 50% of that variation is due to genetics, and the rest to environmental factors, whatever that is. Very nebulous concept, environmental factors. So what it turns out, everybody would say, including me, okay, that environment, of course, is primarily your upbringing, right? It's your childhood, it's where you come from, rah-rah, Freud, and so on. But no, that hardly means anything for your personality. It turns out that, you know, the shared environment, as they say in scientific terms, the environment that you grow up in does not really measurably affect your personality. It doesn't. What affects that personality environmentally is, it's other things. It's your experience with peers. It's the environment that's not your home environment, which is interesting. As I said, it's something we have known, and it's been in the psychological literature since the 70s. It has not sunk in culturally. I mean, most people and most psychologists will still look at your childhood and say, that's where everything comes from, right?
So why is that the case?
I think it's because it's counterintuitive that it wouldn't mean anything. And of course, it's not that it doesn't mean anything for you as a person, but your personality, that sort of basis of who you are and how you look at things that isn't changed by your childhood. I think the best example is if you look at adopted children, their personality, when you measure it, is not related at all to the family they grew up in that was not their biological family. You simply can't measure, you can't see when you take personality measures that an adopted child would have anything to do with that non-biological family that they grew up in. So if you went out to the street, took a person who came down the street, measured their personality, that would be as much related to that family personality as the adopted child who grew up there.
Wow.
Yeah. Of course, you get values, perhaps, or you get habits, or you get things that you do or you care about or whatever from your family, right? From how you grew up. But it doesn't really affect your personality, like how extrovert you are, how neurotic you are, how open you are.
As part of the film, you actually look at the psychopathic gene as well. And I recall you meet with someone who's a, what would you?
He's a friendly psychopath. It's, yeah.
I was going to use that term, but it just sounded so strange. That
That's what he calls himself.
Perfect. And what causes him to be a friendly psychopath then?
Well, the thing is, of course, we look into certain aberrations, right, of genetics and personality. And it's not that there is one psychopath gene or one gene for depression or whatever it is, but psychopathy or antisocial personality disorder, as you would say, of course, it has certain brain characteristics. And you can basically measure certain brain activity, look at that, and see patterns in psychopathic individuals. And some of that will, of course, go back to genetics. It will be partly heritable. Not exactly heritable, but there are genetic clues. Anyway, so this guy, James Fallon is his name, and he's written a book about this. We went to see him because he's a scientist himself. He has worked with brain biology. He has analyzed psychopaths. And suddenly, he saw one day one of the brain scans he was looking at and say, oh, there's a prime example of a psychopath here. And it turned out to be his own brain scan that had been mixed in there. And so he started to look at, okay, what then determines whether somebody with a psychopathic personality turns out to be, you know, a murderer or some crazy guy who ends up in prison or a nasty CEO or just a, you know, friendly scientist who drinks a bit too much. And by telling his story and getting into this, we got into, so how can environment and genetic predispositions, in fact, work together to create a result? And he had grown up in a family that had been very warm. And, you know, he was also a bright kid. And so he turns out fairly well. He's probably also not like, there is, of course, a psychopathy scale, right? He's not really out there like some other bad examples. But he has those traits of not being really empathetic. The way he explained it to me was that, yeah, you know, I know when somebody feels bad and I can relate to that. But it doesn't hit me harder if it's my own family or somebody else. Mm. And that's a big difference. I mean, for me and probably for you, for most people, you have much more and much deeper and more immediate empathy with those you're close to, as opposed to somebody out there on the street. It's not the same. So he has a genetic load. He has these personality traits, but he grows up in a very positive environment that steers him in a direction where he lives a good, productive life. He doesn't hurt anybody. Whereas you can have the same traits, but grow up in shitty circumstances and end up in prison or, you know, being one of those nasty CEOs.
Hmm.
Yeah.
What impact does that then have on our sense of self, the idea of predestination and other similar conversations? What would be your conclusion having gone through this process?
Well, one thing I would say is that we're not predestined. That is definitely not what genetics tells us. What it tells us is that we have a starting point. We have some kind of basis. And we are different in that way. So it's not like we thought in the 70s, oh, with the environment, if we shape the environment, we can shape people to whatever. No, we are not blank slates. We come with a basis for something, a personality or personality traits. We come with an IQ potential. IQ is one of those aspects of human psychology that has been studied the most, and it is 60 to 80% heritable. You can't really do much to change your IQ. And you come with a temperament. And of course, if one thing I should say, if your upbringing, your experiences in an early life are really, really horrible, if you have adverse conditions, yeah, that interferes with everything, right? That is not good. But if we're talking about normal kind of environment, normal upbringing, no abuse, you know, that kind of stuff, then you have different possible trajectories. But you should look at it as, I have a starting point, I can go different places, I can develop into different pathways here, but I can't go way out to one side. If I'm a very neurotic person, I'm never going to be whatever psychologist I go and talk to, whatever mindfulness courses I take, whatever I do, I'm not going to be a person who never worries or very, very happy, whatever. We have certain things to deal with, all of us. We also have things to deal with that come from our early upbringing. For example, and that's something I go into in the book about love, how secure did we feel our attachment to our parents? How secure was that in those early years, you know, first 3 years? That means something for how we expect other people to be. That means something for our relationship with other people for the rest of our lives, whether we're secure or insecure in attaching to other people. So we all have things to deal with. And from that, we can look at ourselves and say, okay, this is something I have no fault in my IQ. I didn't determine that. My parents did. Thank you very much. My personality traits, also very genetic. And from that, you have to forgive yourself for certain things. For example, okay, there are things I can't do. If I'm not very musical, I'm not going to be a pianist, right? But then take a good look at yourself and say, well, are there things that I can do? Are there things in myself, in my own character, I'm not particularly crazy about? Then, you know, go work on it. Because if there's one thing that we know from genetics and from brain science, it is that we are not predetermined. We have a starting point, and then you can work with it to a certain degree. And realizing that both you can work with things, your personality, especially your psychological traits, but you can also not recreate yourself as something quite different. That knowledge, I think, is very healthy, because then you realize, okay, there are things I can do, but also nobody can blame me for not being a completely different person, because that's not going to happen. I think it sort of frees you to have a better life, to not beat yourself up, and to not let other people beat yourself up, and optimize what you were given.
That's a great perspective that you have now upon reflection. But I noticed in the book and in the film that you felt like a loser when you found out you had 5 to 6 vulnerable genes.
Yeah. What we go into is we look at, so what do we know about vulnerability in relation to your psychological health, mental health? And I come from a family with a history of depression. I have depression myself. I take antidepressants just for not having another episode. So it's a preemptive strike on my part. And so we wanted to look into, what do we know about the genetics of mental health? And quite a bit is known. Again, it's partly heritable. Depression, for example, is about 40% heritable. And so I went in for analysis of the genes. It was at that time, you know, a handful of genes that we know exist in both a vulnerable version and a more robust version. And it turned out that, again, I was sitting across from this researcher who'd done the analysis, and she just she was a very cool person, not very emotional. And she just lists them up one after one. So this one, you have two copies of the vulnerable version. Mm-hmm. Okay, next one. Yeah, you have one copy of the vulnerable version. And, you know, on and on and on, all about vulnerability. And as you say, I felt like a loser in the genetic lottery. I was just, whoa, that's all shit, you know. But then, you know, reflecting on it, I came to the result that, yeah, it makes sense. I mean, I have these depressive sides to my personality. I worry a lot. I'm not very resistant to stress. That makes sense with this genetic load. Also, I started to look into, well, in fact, I mean, I'm not a disaster, right? I don't have chronic depression. I deal with depression. I deal with the stress. I do, you know, I have a job. I do things. I'm not a failure here. So something must have been not so bad about those vulnerability genes. And it turns out that you can look at it in a different way. It's not just about vulnerability or robustness. It's really about those, what we call vulnerable versions of genes, also make us more malleable. So if you have tons of those vulnerable versions, and if you have a challenging childhood, you know, negative experiences, so on and so forth, you might end up depressed, anxious, mentally ill. But on the other hand, if you have close emotional relationships with your parents, other people during your childhood, you may end up using that vulnerability in a positive way. That's what it looks like, that you are malleable. So if you have a lot of positive stuff, human relationships mostly, in your life, it's not about socioeconomic parameters, it's about human relationships, then you can kind of flourish because of those vulnerable or malleable genetic versions that you have. I find that very interesting. And it tells us something about genetics as well, that it's not that there are bad genes and good genes. It all depends on what is the environment, the life situation that you're in. And that makes sense, that nature should not have purely bad genes, because if they were purely bad, they would have been rooted out by evolution, right? They would disappear out of the population. But no, some of these genes that might turn out to look bad in a certain life situation might be actually quite good in a different one. So everything we know about nature and biology, it always has surprises. It's never as simple as we start out thinking, good genes, bad genes, you know, good personality, bad personality. It's always more complex and more interesting.
And you mentioned genetic discoveries dating back to the 1970s that weren't necessarily acknowledged for a long period of time. On somewhat of a similar note, who was Robert Heath?
Oh, interesting, interesting figure. He was a psychiatrist and he worked in New Orleans, Tulane University. He started out there in 49, and he was the inventor, I would say, of deep brain stimulation.
And in layman's terms, what is deep brain stimulation, Luna?
Well, it's it's all about, most people will probably have heard about it in relation to Parkinson's disease. It's stimulation of brain tissue in the way that you implant tiny, tiny, thin electrodes, thinner than a hair, into whatever brain regions need to be stimulated. Because, for example, in Parkinson, you have stiffness or you have tremors, and you can actually treat that by adding that extra electrical activity in certain brain areas. And most people also think that deep brain stimulation was invented in the 80s for Parkinson's disease. That's what I thought until I stumbled upon the name Robert Heath. And it turned out that he had been completely forgotten, written out of psychiatric history. But he invented this stuff and he did experiments and treatments of psychiatric patients all the way back to 1950. And in fact, when I dug into this and what came out of it is a book called The Pleasure Shock which has the story of this inventor, this really sort of intrepid pioneer, who also had his personality against him and had his times against him. And so what happens with somebody who invents this amazing new technology for treatment of mental illness? How come he gets forgotten? How come he just sort of disappears out of history? And his technology reappears many years later, and he's just completely forgotten.
It struck me whilst reading your account of Heath that he's an enigmatic man with a somewhat difficult personality and cavalier nature. Was that the main contributing factor to his downfall, or was he?
He also had ideas that were way ahead of his time, like way ahead of his time. He was active in the Freudian heydays, when especially American psychiatry was all about Freud and analysis, and, you know, mental illness, schizophrenia par excellence, was not about the brain. It was about your upbringing. It was about your mother. It was always your mother, right? But Heath had the idea, he was both a psychiatrist and a neurologist, and he had the idea that, well, we are dealing with brain diseases here. We have to look at the brain. We have to look at the brain's activity. And as the brain is an electrical and a chemical organ, why not try to apply that electricity where something has gone awry? See if that works. And it did work, in fact. And what he did, he started out with schizophrenic patients. And we have to remember, this is 1950. It's New Orleans. He had sort of the reins of a whole psychiatric ward of patients. And he included, I think, 22 patients in his first experiment, where he implanted one electrode in a certain area of the brain that he thought was central to this, and started stimulating these patients and had actually good results with some of them. But it just, the method, having an electrode implanted, drilling through the skull, putting an electrode into the brain somewhere, having a little thing coming out of their head where the wires sort of stuck out, so they had to wear a hat. And then they came in to the lab once a week or something, and were plugged into the equipment and were given these electrical stimulations. And actually, some had a good treatment effect. Anyway, but it looked weird, right? 1950 looked really weird. And to these Freudians, it was anathema. It was like, what is this guy doing? Let's turn our backs on him. And he just, over, let's say, 20 years or something, became a pariah in the psychiatric community. But he kept on working. And he kept on having a whole department at Tulane. And one thing that was incredible to discover was that he filmed all his experiments. And I tracked down his son and went to see him. And we went to his summer house in Mississippi. And it turned out, because the films, of course, were at Tulane University, they wouldn't let me see them at all. They are under lock and key there. And it turned out that he had copies made and had stuck them somewhere in the summer house. And his son found them and copied all these films and sent them to me. So I could sit here in Copenhagen with my computer and look at these experiments where you have Heath, for example, he's talking to a patient who's lying on a couch or sitting in a chair. You can see electrodes and wires coming out his head. And they talk about how he feels, and does it help him with his rage or his fits or his depression? Yeah, this has helped me a lot with, you know, this one patient I remember who talks about how he has never really felt any true pleasure or joy. That was the first time he sort of really felt that, was when he had his electrical stimulation. And it really is... It's amazing. I mean, it's completely flabbergasting to sit there and look at this. And here you have all these tales about this monstrous scientist who experimented on people like they were rats. And God, this was really awful. And then you see that it looks very much like a current session with a psychologist. Very much. There's just the wires and the stimulation that's different. But these people were not... at least not the ones I have seen, and I've seen many patients, they were not experimented on as rats. They were people who sought some kind of solution, some kind of treatment for serious mental illness. And again, this was the 50s. You had nothing to give them. This apparently helped some of these patients. And today, that's what I write about in the book as well. When you look at what they do with deep brain stimulation today, it is now becoming a treatment for depression, for OCD. Some people are looking into schizophrenia. So all the things that Robert Heath did and what he thought, and even the brain areas that he was stimulating, that's coming into vogue today. So he was really a pioneer, but he had his personality against him. He had the times against him. It was especially the 70s. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Mm. That whole anti-psychiatry movement, it killed him, basically. And then he also, there's a case that I found doing the research and finding some of his early collaborators, that there was this guy in his lab at some point who was really a big fraud, and who his fraud really was the nail in Heath's coffin. That's an interesting story, and it's one you have to read. Yeah, it's complex and it's strange.
It is indeed. Yeah. One thing that I think is really fascinating in your book is that you then refer to another paper that I'm paraphrasing here is asking the ethical question, how happy is happy enough?
Yeah.
And the idea that, well, if on a scale of 1 to 5, 2 is functioning and you're feeling okay,
yeah,
why would you not want to go to 5 and experience extreme pleasure? The other question that you ask is, how could this potentially be used in the future? And I wonder whether we would ever get to the point where it could be similar to that of cosmetic surgery, whereby we can enhance the state of our brain. What are your thoughts on that?
I think we definitely will get to that stage. I mean, there's an awful lot of work being done on what you might call neurocosmetics. I mean, if you can use technologies like deep brain stimulation that is being developed and refined, and the equipment becomes smaller, and at one point it won't be electrical stimulation anymore, it'll be magnetic stimulation, and so on and so forth. If you can, in a way, affect your brain so that you, for example, feel more pleasure or have more intense emotions, or even, let's say, numb yourself. If you're a very anxious person, if you're traumatized, or, you know, you want to block something out, what's to say that you shouldn't do it? We used to say in the old days, you know, let's say 20 years ago, that it's okay to treat diseases with medicine or technology or whatever, but you shouldn't interfere with normal human function, normal biology. Why not? That's the question. And if you ask most ethicists today, what they'll say is, well, that all depends on the circumstances, that there's no objective reason to say that interfering with normal biology, normal psychological function is wrong. Enhancement isn't per se wrong. It depends on who decides. Is it the individual? Is it somebody else? I mean, nobody would say you should be forced to interfere with your normal biology or psychology, but should you have free reins yourself? If it's about technology, for example, if you're a completely normal person who just wants to be happier, would it be okay for you to go and pay for having a neural implant? In a way, my basic feeling about this is that individual autonomy, for me, is the most important thing. I mean, you ought to be able to decide your own life, what you want to do with yourself, your psychology, your biology. You should be able to determine when you want to die, all that stuff. So for me, I have very few restrictions when it comes to what people want to do to themselves. As long as you don't force other people to use some kind of technology or enhancement or whatever it is. But it's an interesting question. If you think about enhancers in general, go into the average American university campus and look at how many people use cognitive enhancers for exams, for big reports, essays, whatever, when you have to produce something. Yeah, people use Adderall, Modafinil, Ritalin, I think that genie is kind of out of the bottle.
It's a fascinating area to explore.
It is. I mean, it is. And the more we know about our brains, of course, the more we'll be able to shape the brain and affect the brain and its functions in all directions.
You mentioned that for you, it's paramount that the individual's right to autonomy is protected. I find that interesting when I reflect on your body of work, that throughout your writing, you're never prescriptive.
Hmm.
Is that a conscious choice of yours to just present the information and not push an agenda? Or is it a reaction to what you see in the world of pop psychology today?
I think that the reason that you have all the prescriptive pop psych literature out there is that it sells. You know, people want solutions, and it will always sell if you can tell people this is what you should do, and then you become happy, or you become rich, or you become thin, or whatever it is. I just think that is sort of, I mean, it's a lie. Of course it's a lie. We are incredibly different as individuals. So it's just, on my part, it's just an acknowledgement that there is no one solution that will fit every one of us. There is not even five that will fit all of us. And it's, I don't think it's interesting really to tell people what I think you should do. It depends on who you are. What I want to do is to show people perhaps, you know, give them some knowledge about ourselves, some ways to understand yourself. And with that, you can think about, okay, how can I apply this in my life? Can this help me in some way? I would like to give people something to think about and some help to figure out what is their solution. Because I can't tell anybody. I mean, I can't even tell my boyfriend what, you know, his solution to his mental problems are. I can hardly tell myself. Yeah, you know, it's about trying to say, here are some tools. Science actually provides you some tools for self-knowledge. Try to use them. See what you get out of them. See what happens.
Mm. Just in closing, Lorna, I wondered if we could talk briefly about a recent podcast series of yours, Lorna Funk and the 10,000 Souls, which ostensibly revolves around the collection of 10,000 brains of former psychiatric patients that have been stored for many years in Lyskol.
Yeah.
But in this series, you also delve deeper into the world of depression and mental health.
Mm.
And one statistic that just keeps ringing in my ears was provided by an expert in the field who suggests that today across the entire population, it's estimated that as much as 85% of people will experience a mental health issue in one form or another at some point in their life.
Yeah.
That's staggering, isn't it?
To most people, that is mind-boggling because we have, of course, the view in society that mental health problems, you know, it's not the norm, right? It's what you should try to avoid because it's abnormal. Psychological problems are not viewed as the norm, as what you should expect in life. But it is the norm. It is what you should expect in life. What turns out is that when you look at studies of, okay, how many people actually qualify for some mental health or some psychiatric diagnosis, if you just take here and now, look at everyone in Denmark, it will probably be 10, maybe 15% will have a diagnosis or would qualify for a diagnosis. Could be depression, could be anxiety, could be anything. But if you look over a lifetime, and this has been shown in very good data from both the UK, the US, and New Zealand, and also, I think, Danish data, in fact, if you look over a lifetime, 85% of us will get a diagnosis or several diagnoses, or at least qualify for them. So if somebody had tested us, we would turn out to have depression or generalized anxiety or OCD, whatever. And what does that mean? That means that it is completely expectable. It is a normal part of living a life. One of the researchers I talked to about this, he said, well, nobody expects to never have physical illness, do they? No, No, we know that's normal. And mental illness is, for a large part, reactions to life. It's reactions to, you know, the circumstances we're in, the demands on us. We have perhaps some are more vulnerable to this than others. They even talk about nowadays in some of the very new research that we shouldn't talk about the genetics of depression, of anxiety, of schizophrenia. All these mental illness problems, they have a shared vulnerability. They call it a P factor. So it's about being more or less vulnerable to psychological reactions. And then what you develop in your life depends a lot on the circumstances and perhaps also on genetics. Are you going in the anxious direction? Are you going in the obsessive direction? What is it? But we should really talk about vulnerability. So you're more or less vulnerable, and then you can get into circumstances that can make these things, you know, break out. It's like, as one other researcher said, it's like the psychological immune system, right? Sometimes it just breaks down.
And through this exercise of investigating mental health and how it's perceived by society, where do you think we are today in terms of dealing with it? Is there still a stigma attached to it, or are we far more open?
It's interesting. Psychiatric illness has become a major topic of the era, right? We talk about psychological issues and illnesses all the time. We talk about diagnoses. We talk about mental illness. There are some people who still say, oh, but it's taboo. No, it's not taboo. We talk about it all the time. We write about it all the time. We hear about it all the time. It's not taboo. It's sort of become that big monster in our culture that we focus so much on our psychological health. And I think this realization that it is normal, it is normal. A lot of children will develop psychological problems. That's how it is. A lot of adults will develop different kinds of psychological problems over a lifetime. That's how it is. And we deal with it. And it's transient because you have a depression or you have some anxiety attacks or you have a little OCD at one point in your life, it doesn't mean that you are chronically ill. These are episodes. But the realization that it will happen to almost all of us should eliminate the stigma, I think. This is normal. And we should talk about it and relate to it as something normal and expectable that we then handle as it comes along. And I think what we're doing now in culture, at least in Western culture, is that we focus so much on our own psychological health. How am I feeling? Am I really happy? Am I more anxious than I should be? Am I a little depressed? Is there something traumatic in my life or in my past? Get over it already. You know, deal with problems if they really turn out to be problems, but just live your life, handle it. If you're depressed, do something about it. I mean, if it's bad enough, go see a psychiatrist, get some treatment. Get psychological treatment, get medication, do whatever, but we should not be so sensitive. It's like we almost, all of us sort of expect all the time, oh, I will get psychological problems or my children will, and it's horrible. It's terrible. No, it's just normal. You know, get over it, deal with it. It's transient. Live your life. I mean, as a culture, we should not be, it's like we're cultivating vulnerability. We are cultivating the idea of, oh my God, society is making us ill. No, we are making ourselves more vulnerable than we ought to be. We should, in a way, I think the best thing we could do culturally is to relax about mental illness and just handle it as it comes along with the treatments that we have. Help each other, for Christ's sake, you know. Let's talk to each other about the problems that we have and not always talk about it in the language of psychiatry. I have OCD. I have a little autism. I have da-da-da. We all have problems, be it this, that, or the other. But it doesn't do anything good necessarily to always try to put it into these diagnostic boxes, for example.
Just finally, Lona, you seem to have always been more than happy to put yourself front and center in your own work. Your childhood, about love and loss and affairs and all these things.
Yeah.
I'm just curious if that's always come naturally to you, because to me that requires a great deal of vulnerability.
Hmm.
Is that something you've developed over the years as you've found your voice as a writer, or do you think it's just an innate part of your personality?
I think the latter, in fact. I think I grew up with always being able to talk about whatever I felt, whatever I thought. You know, in our family, we talked a lot about people and who we are and, you know, our psychological ins and outs. And I think I was always sort of taught not to be ashamed of myself in any way. Just be who you are. And don't ever think about what other people might say. Doesn't matter. Do what you want. Be what you want. And I think that has sort of just turned into the way that I live, pretty much. I mean, I don't find it embarrassing to tell people that I've had depression. Why would it be embarrassing? It's not especially my fault or the fault of anyone else. It's just, it's the fact of life. And if somebody else can learn from it, can learn from me telling about how you handle loss, how you can handle the affairs you had in your marriage or whatever problems you can get into, I simply think it's just, you can say I use myself as a resource for telling these stories, as an illustration of, you know, human life. I'm just a person, and this is what a person can encounter in a lifetime, and how you can deal with it and how you maybe shouldn't deal with it. Or, you know, I simply don't feel the embarrassment about telling these things that a lot of people feel. So when people say to me, oh, you've been so brave talking about this in your book, I'm not brave. Maybe I don't have the same avoidance reaction that you have. So for me, it's easier. But if I can make it easier for other people to talk about their problems, if they want to talk about it, then I would have done something good, I think.
Well, it's been such a pleasure hearing your insights about the work and your own personal story today, Lorna. And I just want to thank you for sharing it, as always, with such honesty.
It was great. Thanks for the invitation.
Nordic Portraits is a series by me, Ben Catford. The music was composed by Nina Liu, and the visual identity by Copenhagen-based studio Frame. To learn more about today's guest and all the others from this season, visit nordicportraits.net. You can also follow us on Instagram, and remember to rate and subscribe on iTunes so we can get the word out. Thanks for listening.